last time we tried to set something up, you were backpacking. Was that in Scotland?
I was in Wales.
You were in Wales. Okay. And I mean, most of the people, the only person who listens to this is my mom. So I think my mom knows a bit about the UK, but I've heard there's people who try to go out. I'm asking you, cause I assume that you, maybe it's a big assumption, but I assume that you know a little bit about this. There's people who go to Scotland and they're trying to do like all the different mountains and hills and peaks in Scotland in one lifetime or something like that.
Monroe bagging. Yeah.
Yeah. What is that? Can you tell me about that?
So Monroe is any Scottish peak that's above 3,000 feet in elevation. So I can't remember how many. There's a couple of hundred of them, if I'm not mistaken. Some of them are quite difficult to get to. Like if you've ever heard of the Culin Ridge, it's quite a famous one. You know, up in the Isle of Skye, they filmed some of the James Bond bits up there and things like that. But the Culin Ridge is one of the hardest bits in the UK, if not the hardest. But there are people that will go out and try and bag every single Munro.
Yeah.
So I've only ever done, how many have I done? I've done two.
Okay.
Yeah, I've done two Munros. Second one's a bit of a cheat because we took a ski lift a little bit of the way up because we were really tired.
Well, that's two more than me.
Yeah, there's actually, just this past week, there was some news that came out. There was a woman who managed, she was the first woman to finish a Scottish winter Munro round. So that means she got to the top of all of those mountains in one winter season.
Wow.
And as you say, there's people who spend an entirety, a lifetime trying to get around those mountains.
How many, do you know roughly how many there are?
Let's have a look.
Okay. Google it. While you're looking, welcome to the Canadian Specific Podcast. This time, Rocky Mountains not included. Today I got a friend of mine that we met at a Christmas party here in Abu Dhabi, and we've been trying to set up something because, you know, if you can't tell already, very articulate man we got here. And I had a quick question about your name here. Is it based off of Diogenes? It is. Interesting. For those who don't know Diogenes, he was a philosopher from the ancient times, but he was the wild one, right? He was the one who threw a chicken in front of, was it Socrates, and said, "Behold a man." I'm probably butchering this.
Also,
a plucked chicken.
We came to see him, and he held his middle finger up to him, told him to get out of his sunlight, and various other things.
Yeah,
I don't think I sort of epitomize any of that.
No,
in my life.
No. You know, you try and take the good, leave the bad. But I think he just commonly very smart guy. But I think he took stoicism probably to the extreme of not caring about anything, and then. Yeah. But you're saying how many mountains did you find out?
So it is 282 mountains that are over 3,000 feet in elevation.
So if you're doing that in a winter, you must be camping and going from peak to peak to peak to peak. No?
Yes.
Okay.
So there are certain ones where there's a couple of Munros in the same ridge and you can kind of pick off a few at a time. There's other ones which are obviously more difficult because you've got to ascend the whole 3,000. And there's some really weird nuances to it. So there's a Munro and there's also something called a Munro top. So if the sort of drop in elevation from one peak to the next one is not more than a certain level, the next one's like a subsidiary peak. And so it's not a Munro by itself.
Okay.
So it's really weird. You actually have to go down a certain level to come back up for it to qualify as a second Munro.
Yeah, this is how I know.
Even in the summer, people will camp out. If you're doing the Culin Ridge, which is sort of 7 or 8, people will try to go the entire ridge over the course of 2-3 days.
Oh, nice.
So they'll camp out on the ridge and things like that.
Yeah, this is how I know that there's nerds involved, because there's lots of rules.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Have you ever seen...
It's an official thing that people go out for, you know, competing for how quickly they could get around it. There's an official list.
Yeah.
Of course, involved.
Yeah, there was all these recently, there's been a bunch of different documentaries that have popped up on Netflix. But have you ever seen The Alpinist?
I've heard of it. I've not watched it.
You have to watch it today. It's amazing. It's amazing how a documentary film can say so much by just not saying anything, where they just like leave you with him on the mountain while he's climbing. But he does a lot of the climbing, like free soloing and stuff like that. And the film crew, he comes across as very, I don't know if humble's the right word, but he's quite He's just really into it, and he doesn't really want to be doing it for anyone else. So the camera crew and stuff, they're trying to like find him, not on the mountain, but like in the world from time to time, because they're supposed to shoot something, and he just disappears and goes and climbs a mountain and breaks a record without them around. He's like, okay, now I'll take you to go do it again. But it's a heart-wrenching one too, but it's amazing. I highly recommend. If you got nothing else to do for the rest of your day after this, go and watch it. I think this is the second time I've brought this up on the podcast.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. I'll definitely look at that. The other one I want to watch is the Nimsdai Purger one. I haven't got around to watching that one yet. I can't remember. It's Seven Summits, is it called?
Oh, he goes and he does them all in a year?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
That one was very good as well. I really like that one. And then there was another one about the earthquake in Nepal.
Yeah.
That we watched. That was pretty good. That one's like, there's some summiting, but they show you like, this is the stories of someone who was like trying to summit Mount Everest during the earth. Maybe it wasn't Mount Everest, but they were trying to summit a mountain. A bunch of people. So I think it was Mount Everest, but a bunch of people trying to summit it. And then people who were just walking down through some valley, but obviously, you know, valleys in Nepal are very high up and they're between two mountains, and a whole village getting just taken out. And then the city itself, I can't remember what the city's name is in Nepal, but the big one. And they show you like how the one earthquake across the entire country just shook it. Pretty, pretty wild. Also on Netflix, you can find it. I don't know the name. I should find the name if I can. But
I've got in a few weeks, sort of the 19th of April, there's something that happens every summer. It's called the Kendal Mountain Festival. So Kendal's a town in the Lake District of the UK.
Okay.
And they do a little film tour. So they do loads of stuff. Of course, they do. Up at the actual festival, they've got trails runs and kit shows and talks and everything. It's like a, you know, any other festival. There's all sorts of things going on. Coachella for mountaineers, maybe. You could even go that far. But they do a film tour in the months and weeks leading up to it. And They're coming to one of the cinemas close to where we live. So myself and another friend, who are both hikers and both scout leaders, are looking at getting tickets for our scouts, because it's sort of one evening and they've got three or four sort of documentary length films they show. So three or four sort of between 30 and 45 minute films.
Okay.
And then they've got that comes along to do something. Mm. And so, yeah, we were just emailing them this week saying, yep, we'll take 30 tickets.
Yeah. Yeah. Send them on way. Yeah. No. And I mean, the kids might not understand it till later. I don't know what age group you're working with. They might not understand it till later, but this could be very, not just educational, but like inspiring for them to see this. And like, it's very healthy. So it's a dangerous hobby potentially on where you're going, but a very healthy hobby at least.
Yeah. And they're 14 to 18 and we take them.
Oh, well, there you go.
So they're old enough to understand and old enough to be at a point where that, you know, that really is the point, giving them something that could inspire them, that could spark something off and say, yeah, do you know what? I'd like to go off into the mountains for a couple of days. Or do you know what? I'd like to get into this sort of photography even. Or I'd like to run an event like this, because there's sort of multiple dimensions to something like that.
Or you don't need drugs to get high.
Yeah, I wouldn't quite use that phrase, but yeah, sure.
Yeah. No, I gotcha. Right on. How did you get into hiking and stuff? And then I'll tell you how I guess did as well.
Yeah, no worries. So I got into it just because it's something I always wanted to do. I mean, You'd see all these videos and things growing up and you'd think, oh yeah, I'd love to do that. And sort of growing up in Abu Dhabi, I don't think I ever thought it was accessible in the same way, because you know, you don't really have, well, you have stuff there in sort of Atta and Oman, but didn't really see it as accessible. Thought about it in the US, never got around to it. And then when I moved to the UK through work, I got into something called the Duke of Edinburgh's Award.
Oh, okay.
So it's a sort of an award that gets run through various sections, and it's meant to, you know, help young people develop independence, resilience. And you've got there's different levels. There's bronze, silver, and gold. And I ended up doing gold through work, and you can do your gold until you're 25. And there's a couple of different components to it. So you've got to do a volunteering for between a year and 18 months. You've got to take up a physical activity for between a year and 18 months. And you've got to work on a skill for between a year and 18 months. You've got to go on a 4-night, 3-day expedition,
yeah.
Which could be canoeing. It could be horseback riding. It could be cycling, but most people do hiking.
Yeah.
least in the UK. And then you've got to go on a residential where you go away for 5 days with people you've not met before and work on a project together. So it's sort of like semi Eagle Scout equivalent in the US, if that makes sense, but sort of not. And so I got the opportunity to do that through work. And for the expedition bit was, we went out walking. So went out on a couple of days expedition. And I think part of the reason I wanted to do the award was it just gave me an excuse to do a lot of stuff that I wanted to do, but perhaps didn't, hadn't quite plucked up the courage or hadn't found the right people to go do it with.
Yeah. So, sometimes it's easier to do things that you want to do when someone tells you to do it. Cause now almost like a sense, cause you probably also got like a sense of accountability because you're with all these timelines and stuff. It sounds.
You wanted to get the award. Yeah.
Yeah. And it sounds, right on.
Yeah. So I went off and I did the expedition, and of course you then get trained in hiking and expedition skills, and then try to do a couple other challenge hikes and things around that, because I, you know, it just helped me work on my skills for the expedition. And then for the volunteering bit, I started volunteering as a scout leader, which then took me down this whole other path of, you know, volunteering with young people, stuff that I always wanted to do, not having access to scouts myself growing up, but hearing my parents talk about it from when they were younger. And then it sort of came full circle because I finished off my Duke of Edinburgh's award. I'd been meaning to volunteer in the community, find something to do, because I'd just moved to London a year before that.
Yeah.
And just the volunteering bit gave me an excuse and gave me a reason and a sort of pathway. And I stayed and then sort of picked up more responsibility. And now I look after the entire district and I run DME myself. So I run expeditions for the young people. So it sort of become a bit of a full circle moment. And we're off in 2 weeks to the Brecon Beacons. We're off in to Wales in 2 weeks with a group of 8 or 9.
Holy smokes, that's awesome! Both awesome and admirable. And I guess another thing, man, we got a couple things. I will tell you about how I somehow got into hiking. But before we do that, people can't tell by your accent, right? Do you mind letting us all know, so where you've lived, where you're, and maybe also too, like where your parents are from, and just a brief summary of how that works?
You want the potted history then, right? I always have this classic joke where people go, where are you from? And I've asked them, do you want the 5 minute answer or the 5 hour answer? I'll have to give you something in the shorter end of the spectrum, I suppose. Yeah. So as you said, Diogene, my name is Greek, but nothing to do with Greece at all in the family. My dad just liked the name. And my sister's name is African. She found it in a book and he really liked that as well. But my family from Goa, which for those of you who know, used to be a Portuguese colony. The Portuguese were there for 500 years. It's on the west coast of India. And so the family's got Portuguese ties in that sense. My granddad was in the Portuguese military. And then in 1961, when the Indian Army came in and took over Goa and the Portuguese left, my granddad had the option to stay or leave. And that was in December of 1961. And my grandmother and my grandfather got married in November. So they were sort of a month and a bit, 5 weeks into their marriage, and they were offered the option to either stay or leave.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until years later that we found out that, you know, one of my granddad's friends, who was a police officer, told him, you probably shouldn't go. And probably worked out, because Salazar, who was the Portuguese sort of dictator, when all of his officers came back to Portugal, he imprisoned them because in his eyes, they'd failed.
Oh yeah. My goodness.
So I don't know what my family's history would have been if my granddad had decided to go back to Portugal.
You'd be in prison,
but he decided
maybe.
To stay in Goa. And my dad was born. My dad and mom met in Goa. And then I was born there. And we lived there for the first couple of years of my life with my granddad.
Real quick, is the Portuguese why your parents are so good at dancing?
Yes.
Interesting. Okay, yeah. Okay.
And just the culture in Goa is far more westernized. And if you get the chance to visit, it's a lovely place.
Yeah.
The culture is so much more westernized than the rest of India. It's a very different culture. And many people still think of it as a different country. Like my grandparents' generation would still say, this is Goa and the rest of it's India. And there is a difference.
Yeah.
So, you know, English was a medium of instruction. Portuguese was a medium of instruction, you know, dance culture, a fusion of different dances, different cultures, different foods. So it really is a melting pot by itself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then late 90s, my dad moved to Abu Dhabi for work, for better opportunities, because Goa is lovely, but it's a bit of a tourism hotspot, and used to be a bit of a hippie haven back in the 70s and 80s.
Yuck.
And kind of went downhill. There's not much
Oh.
left there for the people who actually wanted to live there. It's very touristed and not very livable
Oh,
anymore.
yeah.
So
So
it's,
other people are buying houses and stuff there and pushing the
yeah, so
locals out. Yeah.
what's happening in other places? So yeah, they moved in the late 90s, and then we followed in 2000, moved to Abu Dhabi, and then we're there ever since. So most of my life, I genuinely don't remember very much of my life in Goa, because we moved when I was 4. I don't remember very much of it aside from bits and pieces with my grandparents and things I've seen in photos. So most of my life was Abu Dhabi, and I lived in Abu Dhabi until I was 17, and I went off to university in the US and lived in Michigan for 4 years and got a degree, bachelor's degree in aviation ops and management. And then on the back end of that, was trying to figure out what I wanted to do, and ended up moving to the UK to get my master's degree. In the middle of that, I went and lived in Texas for a month because I got the opportunity to work to get my aircraft dispatcher's license, which was a sort of fallback career path or alternative career path
Yeah.
if some of the stuff I wanted to do didn't work out. And then came over here, got my master's, and then started working where I do now at Heathrow Airport immediately after my master's. And it's been 6 and a bit years now that I've been in the UK. So the accent is very much a combination of various things over the years. And I was speaking to some American friends. They say, "Oh, you sound awfully British now." And if I talk to my British colleagues, they say, "You don't sound British at all. They don't know what you sound like." And it's really strange because you also realize how much it depends on the people you're talking to. I've got, if I talk to Spanish friends and Italian friends, I don't know if you've ever heard of sort of linguistic mirroring, I think it's called, where
I haven't heard of it.
you try and pick up on the way the other person talks to sort of help the conversation go better, and it's a sort of natural human thing. And I realized it once when someone said to me, "So, do you realize when you talk to the Spanish people, your sort of tone, your inflection, your sentence structure changes entirely because you're talking to them, and then you go off and you talk to someone else, and it's completely different." So, yeah, very much a mutt of an accent, I think.
Yeah, that's funny. I do the same thing with my friends where I go like more Albertan, but then for work and stuff I'll be a bit more proper. But I can't, I don't know what it is with my brain, but I don't like I will probably never say mate. That's a thing everyone wants me to say here. I probably never will, but there's certain things that
If you move to the UK, it comes naturally.
yeah, they're saying it all the time. Yeah, but I have another friend here. I won't name names, 'cause they're just a friend here. But she's from the US. And so that's the Midwest. And sometimes she sounds like a school teacher from where I'm from. Sometimes she sounds a little British. Sometimes she's like the what I would almost call like the international accent, which I would probably start putting you under, because I notice actually now what I'm listening to now without a beer in my hand, I pick up different things now that I wasn't able to before. Yeah, I don't have the best ear for this, but no, it's very interesting that you say that. So that mirroring piece is probably why I notice. Yeah, when people just start talking, and it's funny too because you'll even do it without seeing the person or talking with them. You'll just on the phone if you know who you're talking to. You can revert back into how you usually talk with, whether it's your friends or your parents, because you also talk to your parents differently than you talk to your friends too. That's very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's very random for me, because even at work, I used to be a duty manager, and you'd pick up the phone and you'd be talking to airlines, and you could be talking to anyone from anywhere in the world because we've got that many people there, or you could be talking to anyone anywhere in the world because you'd be calling an office halfway across the world for something. And you do the same thing there,
Interesting.
where you just pick up on the person's accent and you just pick up on their sentence structure, and you kind of, yeah, I think it's quite an innate human thing. It's trying to sort of build that relationship by subconsciously your brain goes, "Oh, if I sound like you, then we can get along, and we can work together, we can be friends."
Yeah. Right on. And just do you have the stats right now? Like, how big is Heathrow, like top 10? Is it the biggest airport? I can't remember.
Yes, it's definitely top 10. Depends on how you measure it. So we're not the top airport by air traffic movements. That usually goes to Atlanta because they've got a lot of small regional stuff.
Interesting. So Atlanta, US?
In the US, yeah.
Okay.
So let's have a look. I'll look it up while we're talking.
Okay.
By passenger volumes, we're usually quite high up there. So last year was just under 80 million passengers, which is pretty much on what we were 2019,
okay,
pre-pandemic.
Yeah.
And I suppose this year would surpass that. But yeah, so Atlanta last year, or 2023, Atlanta had 104 million passengers. Dubai had 86, and we had 79. So we're number four, actually. So
number
it's Atlanta, four. Dubai, Dallas, Fort Worth, and then us, and then Tokyo, the top five.
Interesting. Wow.
Yeah. So we're definitely up there, definitely very busy.
Yeah. Well, you got a fascinating resume, so to speak. All right. Now I'll tell you about how I got into hiking, much, much different from your story. I guess I was sort of born into it, so to speak. So I grew up in rural Alberta in the prairies, and there's a big hunting and fishing culture, and you know, just a few generations ago, that's what people had to do even just to eat. But, you know, when you're going hunting, you gotta put your boots on and start walking. And then from there, you know, my family and I, we always like doing things outdoors. We never went on specific hikes per se, but we would do trips to the mountains quite often. And whenever you go to the mountains, you're always going to go out on a trail or two. So the Rocky Mountains were about 6 hours away from us, 4 to 6 hours, depending on if you're going to Jasper or Banff. It's probably five to seven hours, because we're on the other side of Edmonton. But so that was something. And we also would go to Drumheller. So Drumheller in Alberta is this place where they find lots of dinosaur bones, because I can't remember what the geological terms are, but pretty much there's like a cut where like a river went through or something at one point, or I think a river, but the landscape just sort of opens up a little bit, and then you can see all the layers and there's dinosaur bones and stuff. And they got this amazing, it's the Royal Tyrrell Museum, amazing dinosaur museum. If you're ever in Calgary, just take a jut out there. It's opposite direction of the mountains, but it's an amazing, I've been there so many times. Me and my wife, when we were in Canada, I think 3 years ago during the pandemic, we still went just to go. And, you know, we're going to go back to Canada in June, July. And I would, if I'm in the area, I would just go and do it again. It's so good. But yeah, so when you're out there too, like lots of hiking, and we did a lot of canoeing too. Growing up, we would put canoes in the, so my, where I grew up, it was on acreage on a riverbank. So we would put canoes in the river upstream, and we would canoe home. And then we would pull the canoes out of the water and come up. And sometimes you'd fish while doing that, or, you know, you'd go and you'd pretend you're hunting, but you're kind of just canoeing, looking for deer and stuff. But yeah, so, you know, a lot of people from, you know, just rural Alberta or rural Canada end up sort of being born into it. But then you got like pockets of like where the hippies live. One of them is Squamish. Squamish? I think it's Squamish. Yeah. In BC, they're like little enclaves where everyone shares things, you know, there's no rule of law, terrible place, but people will go there just to work. But their primary goal is to like climb mountains. And I think Squamish is where, I'm pretty sure it's Squamish is where that one guy is from. Let me just double check that, the alpinist, but they, So you'll see that and kind of all in Saskatchewan, which is a province over from us, just tons of fishing. I think in northern Saskatchewan, there's more lakes than there are fishermen. There's just so many. But most people live as far south in Canada as possible.
Yeah, because isn't it something like 90% of the population's within 100 miles of the U.S. U.S. border, and then go up beyond that, and it's just sort of the wild.
Yeah, pretty close. There are some pockets up north, but yeah, no, that's how that works. And then I did some sea cadet stuff. So I was in the prairies. There's no ocean, but they still had sea cadets. I did that. And then I ended up joining the Canadian Army when I was old enough as well. So lots of hiking in there, but different type of hiking. But anyways, yeah, so I'm very happy to discuss hiking with you. And that was very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's just really cool, right? Because for me, hearing about friends who kind of were able to go out and hike and things with their families, and like that sense of adventure growing up.
Mm-hmm.
I guess growing up in Abu Dhabi was something that you got in a very different sense, and something I feel like I potentially missed out on. Like we used to go camping whenever we could, but you camp on a beach, somewhere in a wadi. You know, it wasn't the same as kind of going out completely into the wilderness. You were never very far away from sort of civilization. So yeah, I guess I always quite like hearing these stories from people who have grown up in places where it's like, oh yeah, well, you know, when I was 14, me and my older brother used to, you know, just disappear off for the weekend into the forest. And you know, yeah, we'd come back on Sunday at some point and we,
yeah,
you know, or you could just, at the end of the school day, you know, on a typical Wednesday evening, there was a river you could go swim in. And I would have loved to have that sort of stuff growing up. But, you know, growing up in a city, I guess it's very different.
Yeah, for a while we used to go fishing at the old ferry crossing just down the road from us, and all the local kids would show up. You had to be like, know someone who could drive you there, but we'd all go there until the RCMP started showing up all the time. I think there was a pesky neighbor who, you know, grew a little too big for her breeches, and she, you know, I own that land, but I don't think she did, but it didn't matter. We weren't trespassing though. That's the main point. But yeah, we're really, and I'm very conscious of this, particularly with growing up, because me and the missus, we want to have kids, and you know, we're thinking lots about, okay, you know, I know tons of people who grew up here and they turned out great. Like you're a very good example of that. But that way that I grew up, I think I would want to like mirror that as much as possible, because I think there was something very special about it, and I look back at it so fondly all the time. Even when I'm here, sometimes, you know, sometimes I'll have dreams and stuff about being home. Actually, the last dream that I had about being home, though, I was dreaming about there's a specific type of beer you can get called Black Ice, made by Molson, and then a specific type of Canadian whiskey made by Weiser's. For some reason, I was looking for that in a liquor store and I just couldn't find it, and I went to another store and I couldn't find it, and that was my dream.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyways, do you mind?
That's really interesting you say that though, because I think, because we talked about this at Christmas, didn't we? Like the way people grow up and what you get in Abu Dhabi. Because I think talking to my parents now, because you know, I'd like to have kids at some point as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think about it too sometimes about the way I grew up. And oftentimes I've had colleagues of mine who I used to work with who then ended up taking jobs in the Middle East, and they knew I grew up in the Middle East. So they, quite a few of them came up to me at various points and said, hey, I want to talk to you. I need to. And their primary concern was never, how much money am I going to make? They wanted to know what it was like for me as a kid growing up, because mm-hmm. they wanted to know if they took their kids there for that opportunity, what that was going to look like. So they wanted to know what schools were like. They wanted to know what the culture was like. And I've had those conversations with my parents, you know, later growing up, or sort of later in my life, not when I was younger, about why they did things and why they were certain ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, safety is a big thing out there. You're not likely to have any, you know, you don't get any violent crime. You get, pickpockets and beggars, but that's really about it. The reasons why are a whole different discussion, I suppose, but in that sense that the sort of safety is there. But then, as you said, it's the other elements of your life that you perhaps don't get as much of. And yeah, like even Scouts was a classic example, right? Where I would have loved to do it when I was a kid. It would have been right up my street. It would have been fantastic, mm-hmm. but the opportunity just didn't exist. I think things have changed significantly now, but at that point, the opportunity just didn't exist. So the sort of extracurriculars you could have were fairly limited. It was kind of, you went to school and then you went down and played football in the car park with your friends, or, you know, you did a few bits and pieces there, here and there, but you didn't really have the sort of, you know, you couldn't disappear for 2 days into the woods. You couldn't just go camping with your friend.
Yeah. If you disappeared,
it's a different sort of independence, I find. And it also, it's a different sort of way people react in the sort of societal hierarchy and stuff there, about the way people treat each other is different. The way people interact is different. And I feel like if your parents don't necessarily step in on that and kind of reinforce some of those values and some of those bits and pieces with you. Like I knew people who grew up in a very different, very similar circumstances to me, but in a very different way. And so the way they interacted with people and the way they sort of treated other people sometimes, you kind of look at that and you go, that doesn't make sense to me. And then you kind of realized later in life that it was down to the fact that, you know, where they grew up and the way their parents did or didn't kind of have those conversations with them. And I feel like that's one of those interesting things about growing up in the Middle East compared to anywhere else is I really appreciate a lot more what my parents did and the fact that they probably had to parent on a completely different level to people living anywhere else in their sort of hometown where you had access to the grandparents and the wider family and everybody else. But you had to, you know, you as parents, potentially that area would have to be absolutely everything because you don't necessarily have the wider family there to sort of fall back on.
Yeah, not as much support. You got to create your own opportunity. And yeah, there is much more stuff here now. I will say though, from what I hear from other parents is their children's activities can be quite expensive. And the other thing that I need to consider too, or that I think I should consider is, right, like in North America, if I have kids and one of them wants to be, you know, a tradesperson, a tradesman, they can go and do that at like 16 or something. But here, you can't really get a summer job as a kid because why would they hire you if they can pay someone significantly, you know, less to do the job and just import in, as well as, okay, now you are 18. The only way to get a job here, there's two ways. The first way is you need to know someone. The second way is you need to know someone and be good. So at the end of the day, you sort of need to know someone to get a job here. You can get here on your merit, depending on the gig, but they're looking for someone who can roll in, set up shop, and start running. They're not interested in training people if you're not like already in the country or if you're not, you know, a local here. Yeah, national. Yeah, exactly. So if I have kids here, I mean, there's probably not a problem with elementary school, but once you got to start like, okay, now they're 18, you're forced to send them to school. And then, you know, if you can get them a job once they're done, like they're forced to do a university level education. Like they got to go right to college, not a trade here. And then you would have to somehow be very confident that you can get them a job after. Oh, I did have a question for you then, because you grew up here a bit of a different time. So related to what I just said, do you think you could have gotten a job here, or do you think you would have had to left to find your initial work or schooling? Like, was there a path available for you could you have stayed in Abu Dhabi the entire time? And what would that have looked like?
I don't think I could have, right? And I've actually spent a good amount of time talking about this or thinking about this.
All right, let's hear it.
Just because I've had these conversations with, you know, parents and friends and other people I know, and they've kind of gone, oh, would you come back? I say, yeah, I might do for the right opportunity. I guess it drops down to sort of the culture and the way things were, right? So I spent 13 years of my life there. I was moved there when I was 4 and moved out when I was 17. And I'm 28 now. So it's been more than 10 years since I've been gone. But I still feel like a lot of things have changed and some things haven't changed. You're still looked at in the light of your age. You're still looked at in the light of your skin color.
Oh my goodness.
You're still looked at on all those levels. And I feel like even though I could turn around and say, I've been at Heathrow Airport for 5 years, 6 years, I've been one of the busiest airports in the world, I could walk in there and people would still look at me as being 28 years old.
Yes. Yes. Oh my goodness. Can we just
feel like I would have, after 13 years, I needed to leave. I needed something different just for myself.
Yeah.
But I don't feel like I would have got the respect and opportunity and chance to be who I am in the same way.
Man, it's interesting to say, because I mean, to be perfectly honest, I thought you were just going to talk about race and passport and, you know, the fact that, you know, if you're not a local, you're a class below, and then there are many classes below that. But
we can talk about that as well.
But the age thing, it's like even me with my job, right? And I got hired here and, you know, eventually people understand, but it takes a long time. But I'm not even that young. I'm not even that young anymore, but man, it is like the most glaring thing that everyone recognizes and comments on, and it impacts how they work with me. So much is age. I'm just like, at what point is someone supposed to be competent here? But people here also work way beyond like 65, 55, like the you're supposed to stop at 65, and sometimes they'll get rid of you, but quite often they'll find work somewhere else and just keep working.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, first off, why? I mean, if you enjoy it, okay, that's great. You love it. But it's just this huge thing where, like, you know, you just, so now what that does, right? So no, that's probably what leads a little bit into like, okay, so if you're around 30, you're practically still 20 because everyone hired here is got so many years of experience, and then they don't really let you like try things.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like that would be the struggle, right? When if you were 18 and you would, well, you probably wouldn't walk directly into a job. You'd walk into a very, very poorly paid job at 18 if you didn't have any form of education, because they'd want to see you have at least a bachelor's degree, which kind of goes back to what you were saying earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
But even if you did, you'd then take so long to climb. Whereas, you know, outside, I found that whether your friends who have worked in other parts of Europe or myself here or in the US, you know, we've been able to take risks and take opportunities. People have taken chances on us and said, do you know what? You're competent. I'll let you have a go at it.
Yeah, yeah.
And we'll, you know, and then you work at it for a bit and something works out. You get a promotion, you move into a new job, things work out. Whereas over there, I don't think that structure in the workplace still exists. Like, you know, from talking to people I know there and from, like, you know, from those situations I've heard, there still isn't that sort of transparency in HR policies and things like that. Like, you know, what is a performance review? What is an annual salary review? Does it actually happen? Do you get a raise or not? It just depends on whether your manager decides they want, or the company decides they want to, or they don't. And so I don't feel like, I feel like if I had for whatever reason only ever stayed there, because I could have gone to university in the UAE, because there are a number of universities there and it's something I did look at. I feel like I potentially would have been okay with it if I had stayed there the whole time. But now that I've been outside and I've seen what the rest of the world is like, it's potentially quite a point of frustration. I don't know that, because that's an alternate universe in which I suppose I stayed in Abu Dhabi. But yeah, I don't know. And I think the other thing for me is, you know, you were talking about trades and trade school and things like that. I feel like the other thing is also just the level of respect that you have for different trades and different things that people could do.
Yeah.
If you'd like to be a carpenter in the Middle East, well, you're not. You're, for the most part, if you're a carpenter, you're a immigrant from, you know, one of the developing countries, and you're paid rather poorly. It's not considered skilled. It's actually almost considered unskilled. Whereas a really good friend of mine out here is a carpenter, and he builds movie sets. Like, yeah, he's done stuff for Star Wars, he's done stuff for all sorts of, like,
oh, interesting, wow,
movies. But he's a carpenter.
Yeah.
But being a carpenter in the Middle East doesn't get you that. You know, it's a completely different world, and it's that sort of society of, you know, unless you've got a corporate white collar job, you're not necessarily,
you don't get status.
Yeah, you don't get status, and it's such a status-based society sometimes, where I feel like, yeah, that can get quite frustrating in its own way.
Yeah.
The long way of saying I probably could have, in an alternate universe, stayed there. I don't think I would have been happy. I think at the point I got to after 13 years, I really needed a change, and that was part of the reason I wanted to go somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And I really needed a change. I really needed something different. I mean, 13 years is a long time.
Yeah. There's going to be a lot of people listening who are like, 13 years, that's nothing. But, oh, yeah. Hopefully. Yeah.
Life.
Yeah, exactly. Hopefully you don't get me in trouble here. I'm still within the country, but I think everything we're talking about is fair game. But, no, yeah. I mean, I don't think you would have flourished as well as you did. I mean, I see very easily, you know, a lot of people get their hands sort of tied here, and you're kind of just waiting in an assembly line to move up or move around and stuff. But yeah, interesting you say that, because yeah, like, I mean, I'll even say it here, like, any interview, like internal interview that I've had with my company or anything like that, first thing I do, I start growing a beard, You know, I get a haircut to try and make myself look a little older. You know, anything I can do to like not draw attention to my age, and it still doesn't work. Still doesn't work. But
very. And it's a funny one, right? Because I'll say something else, and because like I said, I've thought about this quite a lot, and I recognize that there is an incredible amount of privilege in the fact that I can say that I got to leave.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, right? Like, it's because my parents said they'd support me to go off to university. It's because I was able to take that risk. And some people don't have that opportunity. And I've absolutely got to recognize that. And I kind of, you know, I value that a lot more as I get older. Just because, yeah, as you said, some people, they could potentially get their hands tied because they've never had the opportunity to leave, or they don't have the means or the resources or the support from their parents or the support from society, by the people around them, to actually go away. And I still say it, like leaving Abu Dhabi and moving to the US, where absolutely nobody knew my name, was one of the biggest risks I ever took, but was one of the best things I ever did in my life.
Yeah.
And I've done it twice, because I did it moving to the US and did it again moving to the UK. Just took the absolute chance on the fact that nobody knew my name, and I could just start from zero, and I could be who I wanted to be. There wasn't the sort of, I guess, 13-year hangover of I knew him when he was a little kid.
You're touching on all of the things I've been thinking about recently. I've thought a lot about that. But I, before we keep going, I think one thing to highlight is you keep talking about your parents. I've talked about my parents. So obviously, you know, you're way ahead as soon as you have supportive, caring parents that don't want you to end up like everyone else. And then, however, man, like, being able to kind of go away from my parents, shake out a little bit, you know, try this, try that, and then come back to them and see, like, yeah, like if I hadn't gotten an opportunity to go, and like, it's not entirely spread your wings, but it's just like try, right? And trying different things about me when you come back and I visit, you know, or when I interact with my parents. Like I love my parents. I have a great time and interacting with them, and it's not hard. But it takes like a week or two for them, you know, for them to like download and recognize, oh, he does this different. My favorite story, and I hope you laugh because I think it's funny. Growing up, I used to, whenever I was going at supper time, whenever I was going to take the first sip of water, for some reason, I always choked on it. Like, I don't know if I would just like suck and then choke, and then I'd start coughing and everyone laughs at me. And then like I had left home for 4 years. And so I've come home many times, and like I'm not really doing it. And then it'd been 4 years probably since this had ever happened. It happened again, and everyone's like, oh, you always do that, ha, ha, ha. And I'm laughing, and I'm like, guys, this hasn't happened for almost 4 years. But because this is in your mind that, oh, this is a thing that Jaden always does, it never happens anymore. It just happened once by accident. But it's just, it goes right back to like, oh, you know, this is the person that I've always known them to be. But it's just, it was so funny when that happened. But anyways, yeah, like, but it's been great to, because, you know, I grew up in a small town. I was able to go to Edmonton, which is about an hour away, but I was still home lots visiting with family. But, you know, you kind of stretch out a little bit. But it wasn't until like I joined the military, and, you know, I was given a lot of responsibility and actually a significant amount of authority too. And you, like, I really became something else and really thought about what I wanted to be within that context. And, you know, when I can kind of take over a situation and start leading a little bit and interacting with people and kind of figuring out what kind of leader I want to be and what kind of person I want to be and how, because you can think about how, what you want to be, but also like how to get there, how to interact with people in a kind way when you're frustrated, how to help people when you only have so much time. Like, you know, how many times can you let someone fail at something before you assign the task to someone else? Weird little things like that, but you got to think lots about it. But, and it's just like, okay, like we went out, we built a bridge over a weekend. I come back, and then it's like, you go to see your parents and they're like, make sure you lock the gate. it's like, okay, like yes, there was one time, however many years ago, or you know, like, you know, so you gain all this capability. But, you know, I love them for that. And it's actually nice to kind of come back. It's not a bad thing also for that. Like, it's not a bad thing. It's just something that I notice.
Yeah. But
what are your thoughts? Absolutely. I want to hear that.
So again, a really, really, really interesting thing to think about, right? Because, I mean, you've met my parents, and yeah. they were always super involved in the community. Everybody always knew my parents. And I think at some point in my life, I think I've had this conversation with them. I'm sure I've had this conversation with them, probably after a few drinks. But at some point in my life, I did get frustrated because I was always their son. I was never myself, right? Like, and it wasn't because I was upset about anything. It's I did want to be my own person. And you get to that point where you're a teenager, when you're like 15, 16, and you're just like, I just want to be me. I don't always want to be their son. But it was not because I was ever ashamed of it or anything. I was really proud of what my parents did, and I still am. And if I turn out to be, you know, 10% of the type of people they are, I'd be really happy. But at the same time, I did need to be my own person. And I'm quite sure that that was a significant factor in me wanting to leave as well. And like you say, the whole aspect, if you can spread your wings, you can make your mistakes, you can figure things out by yourself. But in that, there was also the element of, I wouldn't have been able to do that, coming back to sort of families being supportive. If they hadn't said, yeah, you know, we'll support you, or they hadn't had the confidence to say, do you know what? We've taught you well. We've raised you well. We feel confident enough that when you go away, you can take care of yourself, and you're not going to kind of get yourself into too much trouble and kind of just waste away a little bit. And so I think that's a really, really big part of it. But yeah, I definitely understand. You know, when you go back, it's kind of like, I go back and my mom's like, oh, here's some money for the taxi. And I'm just like, thank you. But yeah, I do work now.
Yeah.
But I feel like parents are always going to be parents, right? And it's this really weird thing where when I was there in December, it's like, I'm back in the house I grew up in. I'm sleeping in my childhood bed. You know, the people in the neighborhood still know me. They haven't seen me for 5 years, but like people around still know me. And I still know where things are in the kitchen. And it's just like, it was an almost like strange out of body experience, because some things have changed so much in Abu Dhabi. And then I come home and my parents are like, you know, yeah, lock the front door. You know where the spare key is. Can you fix this for me? Can you hang up this painting or fix that bookshelf or something like that? And there's a certain amount of, it's comforting. You come back to that and it's nice. And yeah, it does get frustrating because sometimes you go, you know, I'm 28 years old. You don't need to remind me to do my laundry. It'll get done. Don't worry. Yeah. You know, or I do have money for the taxi, and it's fine, but it's done from, I think the important thing is recognizing that it's done from such a place of love, and it's that version of you that they, you know, they've got to watch you grow up for, I think, from a distance, and they haven't had that involvement. So then you kind of show up after a couple of years, and all of a sudden they've got to catch up, and you know, you've spoken to them and you've told them about things and you've had conversations on the phone. But you get to this point where all of a sudden they've had to sort of accelerate through 4 years of growth in a couple of days that you're there. And I think it takes time, you know, it takes time to catch up. And so, and yeah, the water things.
Yeah. and this is
I wouldn't do that anywhere else, but I go back to Abu Dhabi and I just do that, because that's just, it becomes a reflex almost.
Yeah.
Where you're there, and it's just, it's the environment you grew up in. So like, yeah, I do, you know, I do say yalla when I'm in Abu Dhabi. I don't say it anywhere else, but that's because I grew up in Abu Dhabi, and that was just a thing.
Yeah, no, and I like how you mentioned though, right? Like a lot of it comes from a place of love, but it's not just my parents; it's also my brothers with the water thing. yeah. I'm just trying to. Oh, here we go. How do I was trying to find a poem or a saying, because it was very interesting about like you mentioned about like stepping out of parents' shadows. Here we go. From Alan Lippmann's intricate 1993 novel, Einstein's Dreams, set in Bern in 1905. I'll try and read this properly. With infinite life comes an infinite list of relatives. Grandparents never die, nor do great-grandparents, great-aunts, and so on. Back through the generations, all live and offer advice. Sons never escape from the shadows of their fathers, nor do daughters of their mothers. No one ever comes into his own. Such a cost of immortality. No person is whole, no person is free. Now they're sort of talking about what if we could live forever. But, you know, that I kind of think as I'm going through this, right, and I want to have kids, I think a lot about how, like, how to set them up. Like, I almost would prefer that they never pursue, and if they want to, they can, it's up to them, but if they never pursue a career similar to mine, like to go do something else so that everything is kind of on your own, or for, yeah, a time, go and just live elsewhere and you know, it would suck because, you know, I know my parents, you know, they're very happy for me to be here, and like when I was went on tour with the military and stuff, like I know they're very happy for me. But yeah, like the stepping out of the shadows. Yeah, interesting. Anyways, I hope you like that quote. Maybe I'll send it to you. And
that's a really good one. I'm gonna have to look at that one.
Yeah, I'll let me see if I can. I think I just need to open
WhatsApp me a link or something.
Yeah.
But as you were saying that, you said, I'm thinking about this quote, this poem, and there was another one that popped into my head, so I've just looked it up on the side.
Okay.
So I'm gonna butcher this name, I promise you, but it's Ijeoma Ume Binyuo. But the thing is, it's just a quote. I don't know if it was a poem, but it's something that comes up fairly often. It's called Diaspora Blues. And the phrase is, so here you are, too foreign for home, too foreign for here, never enough for both.
Interesting.
And it sort of ties into
that. Send it to me.
You step out of the shadow and you go, I'm too foreign for Abu Dhabi now.
Yeah.
Because I've been away, but I'm too foreign for where I am right now as well.
Yeah.
Whenever I go back, like when I went back to Abu Dhabi over Christmas, it was so strange because I kind of said to people, I felt like I was in an out-of-body experience because there were some places where if you dropped me blindfolded, I genuinely would not know where I was.
Mm-hmm.
Like the area of town where you live, that used to be desert.
I never,
if you put me there, I would not know where I was, you know? And on the other hand, there's bits and pieces around where we live that's changed massively, but there's still that little cafeteria where you can get a little snack for a dirham. And the kicker to me was that a little thing of chocolate milk, a little Tetra pack of chocolate milk, right? We used to grab them on our way to school and stuff. It's still one dirham.
Still.
Taxi fares have gone up three times, four times in the time I've been away. But little thing of orange juice, a little thing of milk is still one dirham. And if you go to Dubai, and you ride the Abra across the creek, that's still one dirham. And you still just give a coin to the driver when you sit down.
Yeah.
You know, there's no contactless, there's no credit card. It's just show up, one dirham, sit down, get across the creek.
Yeah.
I mean,
for people who
it's
don't
crazy
know,
to think that so much has changed and so little has changed at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. For people who don't know, there's this one little area in Dubai where you just hop on a little boat and you're calling it a creek. It's pretty wide. But you can, like, it's saving you hours of walking to go find a bridge to get it across. But yeah, it's just a dirham, which is pretty interesting.
It's just a dirham, and it's a little wooden boat.
Yeah.
Little wooden boat by them. They've probably got a dodgy little motor in the back.
Yeah.
Driven with a steering wheel tied to an axle. Yeah. And you look at it and you go, not really sure about this, but you know what? No life jackets, no nothing. You just sit down, pay you one dirham, and, you know, have a chat with your friend while you go across.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's how it works. Okay. One more, if you don't mind. So actually, you'd be a great person to talk to about this. So I've been thinking about, I don't know if this is an article, it's just a thought, but what I've been thinking about, I've sort of labeled it the big squeeze. And I don't know if you have noticed this or not, but kind of the bottom line up front is that what I've sort of seen at some workplaces that I've worked at is that there are some workplaces where the culture pushes, it kind of like pulls up to management the decision-making capabilities, and it pushes down to the supervisors all the responsibility. So they're held responsible for decisions that they don't really make. And I mean, I saw this a lot with the railroad in Canada, and particularly with the railroad in Canada, they're also unionized. And it kind of, what it made for was like this whole group of people, supervisors, lower managers, where they're just trying to put out fires. There's no planning involved. They're just getting told, do this, do that. And no one's really like, and because they're not able to say, hey, no, give me a sec to get a plan and put this together. And like, they're just reacting. They're reacting both to decisions being made by higher ups, and they're reacting to the problems that are being shared with them or issues with the what's been going down below. I don't know what your workplace is like. You work at an airport, so that's much more know, there's a lot on the go, but the railroad's supposed to be very, very high risk, high reward as well. But I'm just going to list off a few things, and then maybe you're seeing this, maybe you're not. I'm not saying this is all workplaces, but like what I see is like management has like an insatiable hunger for data. So you're just constantly building reports, putting them together, and then handing them up. And then when you send the report up, they find a problem, and now you got to go solve that problem. So making lots of work. There's like a vacuum, like people are retiring now, and there's sort of like a vacuum that's like pulling people up the chain maybe before they're ready, or pulling people out from external to the company into the company that weren't quite ready because they think that everyone's, I don't know, too young to fill a job post or not qualified enough. Yeah, I got a few other things here, but I don't know, like, have you seen that with your work or your friends or anything like that, or no, not really?
I mean, yes and no, and I suppose it depends on where you are and what your workplace is like and what the broader culture around is like. You know, we did talk about the sort of workplace culture and the age factor in sort of Abu Dhabi and then more generally. So yeah, but I do kind of see it in some spaces and talking to friends as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think the way I'd probably characterize it is by asking the question of where does the action sit?
Mm-hmm.
Who's actually doing the doing?
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because if you think that, like, yeah, people higher up in the company are sort of setting the strategy, they're having the big conversations, they're sort of taking the sledgehammer to the blockades in the way and like breaking the path for you so you can keep going away and sort of doing the doing. But yeah, I think there's a wider conversation just in like workforce as a whole of, you know, where does responsibility sit, and therefore where does the credit sit? Because yeah, the credit for doing something is not necessarily with the person at the top who signed on the dotted line. And I think it's down to your company culture. And oddly enough, I think it's down to your specific team. Even
mm-hmm.
like I'm really fortunate in that I work with some people that I really get on with. I have a really good manager, really supportive team, and really supportive like structure around me. Maybe that's just characterized by being in operations because you just have to get on with it. And you just have to do things. So you've got to find ways to kind of move things forward and everyone pitches in.
Mm-hmm.
But I know it's not always the same because talking to friends in other areas and in other companies, it's not always the same in other places. I definitely do see the whole hunger for data. I think I've got a bit of a, not a problem, but my challenge back is always, well, what are you going to do with that?
Yeah.
generate the report. You can generate the report. You can slice the data a million different ways, but there's a sort of level of intelligence that you need to add to that data before you crunch up the report. So it's, what am I actually trying to achieve from this data? What do I want to see out of it? What sort of result do I want? Therefore, what sort of data do I need, and how do I need to slice it? So it needs to be a bit of a strategy around what you're trying to do. Whereas just creating loads of reports for the sake of reports, that's really great. We have all that data. Let's create these fancy dashboards. Can we actually do something with it? I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. No worries. Yeah. It sounds like you don't have the same struggles with your work. I'm not saying that I have the same struggles with my work right now. Just something that I'd been, I've been seeing.
I do take your point, and I do see the change in like where the responsibility sits.
Yeah. Cause it, look, maybe I'll just
see the talent vacuum as well. That's a really,
yeah,
interesting.
Talent vacuum. Well, here, let me, yeah, I'll just keep listing here. So, typically tech being implemented to benefit the manager rather than the employee, right? Because they're the ones that are decision makers who have the budgets and can spend it. And I'm just talking about general trends in some workplaces, and usually I think they're all large. Unions immediately sort of push up responsibility to the supervisor because it's easier to deal with the supervisor than it is with a union member, because you got to haul them in and do a bunch of work and stuff. That's, you know, probably a bit more inside baseball. I don't know if you guys have any unions with narcissism within managers. So the best managers are typically narcissists. They'll take as much credit as possible when something's going well and say that they did it. And if something does not go well, they'll push off the responsibility to others. Again, very general. The rift between operations and business. So sometimes business gets a little too much control. Actually, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about Boeing, if we have the chance. I know you're an air guy, and I've been hearing things, but I don't really know. So we'll transition that. I'll just read off a couple more things. HR is not typically very helpful to the actual like employees. Do a competence system within companies where we don't just ask people like, hey, is this guy competent? We're like, no, on paper he is. And then that's how they keep getting these crazy people in jobs that probably shouldn't be there. Management bloat. We're seeing like there's not a lot of reward for being committed to your company much anymore, because you're not getting like a raise all the time. Some people will be like, oh, look, you're complaining for nothing. But when you can just jump ship to a new company and immediately get a 2 or 3% raise, or there's no well explained development plan, or what's the word called? It's not just a development plan. It's a sort of that, but just like succession planning. Like there's no, like, I've actually not been in a group that does a lot of succession planning until once I left the military. And then, that's kind of mostly it. So
yeah, I definitely see some of those. So
okay.
I have try and remember which they were. Might work backwards and ask you to repeat. Talent succession planning and people staying in places. Yeah, I think I'm in an interesting situation at my company where you've got a bunch of people who have been there 30, 40 years.
Ooh.
Been there, done that, seen it all, and they're brilliant.
They're going to retire.
They've seen every single situation you could possibly imagine. You can sit down with them and they'll talk about what happened in the winter of 84. And it's great because I love that stuff, right? And I love talking to these people and learning from them and hearing from them. But yeah, there is that vacuum when they're going to start to go. It's going to start to suck people up or in or out. And yeah, I think we've moved into a different sort of culture. I don't know if that's the right word. People don't stay in jobs as long. And there isn't, as you say, that reward. Like loyalty is not necessarily rewarded in the same way. It's almost disincentivized, if I'm honest, from talking to friends and other things. And I just do sort of wonder, is that like a vicious cycle? Has it sort of been self-propagating where people don't stay as long, so companies don't feel like they need to value them? Or is it, you know, what came first, the chicken or the egg? Or did companies start to not value loyalty and therefore people don't stay as long? So which way around was it?
Well, if we consider, like, let's just a pension plan that was like a golden handcuffs, guaranteed payments until you, and then also for your spouse, what that became was economically not feasible anymore. And then like, man, like the railroad, like that was the standard. Everyone stayed for as long as they could. And then they didn't need to hire anyone for 15 years. All the new hires now are new people showing up. They're not getting that crazy good pension plan. So what's the point? Yeah, like I could stay in the industry and just hop to the other railroad if I wanted. That, I mean, like, look, that's what I did. I went overseas to a new railroad and I just took that pension that I had and I put it in some other account. And, you know, I'm not locked to them. But anyways, yeah, keep...
I think that's absolutely, you know, the sort of, maybe you call them like long-term incentives and long-term benefits, which aren't economically viable anymore. And, you know, people are finding other ways to, like, people are, you know, side hustling and putting stuff in the stock market and, you know, investing in real estate and all sorts of other things, because our generation's kind of turned around and said, well, yeah, I'm not going to get the nice fancy pension that my grandparents or my parents potentially had access to, or previous generations or other people at the company. I think it also does create a lot of like disparity sometimes and ill will. And, you know, you talked about the pressures between operations and the rest of the business. Absolutely see that every day, having like worked both sides of the fence, and I still do kind of jump both sides of the fence at times. There's absolutely a pressure if, you know, oh, well, operations are always going to be running from one thing to the next. Operations are always going to be loss-making, and it's the other bits that make money, or operations sometimes make money. There's a lot of pressure there. And even within operations, there's that disparity if, you know, oh, well, you know, some people have been here for 4 years, they might be perfectly competent. Some people have been here for 40 years, they might have been perfectly competent, but they might have become jaded and a little bit crusty and not really ready to go. And they're just hanging on for the sake of those big benefits. And is that the right thing as well? Because then you go into the loyalty has been rewarded, but you're actually not getting anything out of them anymore because they're checked out. They want to go.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that I have the answers, and I'm not saying like I've all of this is directly pertinent to me. I've seen it through friends and things, but mm-hmm. I think it's all happening. It's all there.
Yeah. Okay. I have one solution. It's mostly comical, but you create a department called the pasture. And right before they go to retire, if they start getting a little too crusty, you say, we're going to put you to pasture. You show up, you run parties, you grill burgers, but you're here for 8 hours and you have a phone. And all we want you to do is talk, which they love to talk. And I love listening to them. But, hey, I've got a switch install. There's a little bit of an issue here. Let me call so-and-so. He's in the pasture. He's just got his phone on him. He's drinking coffee. He's calling people sport. But you call him. And then that way the institutional knowledge doesn't leave. They're not crusty and, you know, because like sometimes your decisions you're making are like more of a long-term impact and they don't really care anymore. So they'll do what's easiest. But you still have that wealth of knowledge. You can just rely on them to just, you know, download that to you. But we're going to switch gears a little bit, if that's all right, because we got about 5 minutes until this one ends, and maybe that'd be a good time for me to end this. But planes and stuff, but particularly with Boeing, I don't know if you know anything about this. To be honest, I don't know a lot about what's going on. Is something going on? What's the scoop? What are you feeling?
I've honestly not paid, it seems really strange, I've not paid a massive amount of attention just because I haven't been keeping track of things.
Okay.
I think there are systemic things that are going on from what I've read, at the very least, and I'm, you know, obviously there's elements of speculation in this as well. You know, there have been a number of challenges with their new build aircraft program. There have been, you know, quality issues and things like that. So it's one of those things where you sit and wonder, is it a fluke? Is it just a coincidence? Is there a deeper pattern to it? What's sort of driving all of it? You know, has the company made a decision somewhere along the line that says we're going to cut this in favor of this, and has that done that? Is it a conversation of, you know, like we were just talking about, is it a conversation of talent and not necessarily perhaps having people with the experience of a new build aircraft? I don't know if that's the case. I haven't sort of done enough research to know.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's like a multitude of factors involved. Or is it that there's just too much pressure and everything's just trying to be rushed along and therefore things are being missed out? Or you've kind of gone, well, 95% confidence is good enough. We don't need 99.9. Well, I'm not saying that's what's happened, but, you know, if you've got a rush and you've got to kind of sort of make the 80-20 principle decision of, I'll make that decision on whether I do this or do that based on this information, and somehow the outlier was the one thing that could really get you in trouble, and you're being pressured to make that decision, could that be what's going on? I don't know. I think there's a number of interesting things, and it's going to be something that's really interesting to look at as a whole. And maybe the way to look at it is also look at what's happening with other manufacturers, because it's not just Boeing and Airbus. You know, you've got a Bombardier up in Canada, of course, and then you've got Embraer in Brazil, and you've got others. So those are the larger type aircraft, and you've then got loads of smaller aircraft as well. So
yeah,
what's the difference in people's processes? And of course, Boeing and Airbus are on a completely different scale to everybody.
Yeah. So just trying to pull out the things that I'm very interested in is what you're finding. Like, so you've heard about it, but probably mostly through the news, not really through work. Or have you heard about it at work?
I have heard about it through work.
Okay. But just incident reports?
Incident report.
Okay.
You know, water cooler gossip, I suppose.
Okay.
Or just kind of chatting around and colleagues sending articles around like, hey, have you seen this?
Okay.
So it's quite interesting to kind of look at what's actually happening there. There's an interesting article which I've had to leave had on my bookmarks, just haven't read. There's a news source called the Air Current, and they're a subscription news source, so you've got to pay for them. But what they don't paywall safety related things, and so they've had a couple of the Boeing articles and stuff, and they do sort of deep dive analysis, like long form writing, which is why it's been on my bookmarks list. But they've got a couple of interesting articles around. You know, one of them I've got that I looked at was the fallout for Boeing will extend far beyond 737 MAX 9 grounding. And there's loads of other interesting stuff in there. And there's a, you know, there's one that says decades of corporate decision making have eroded Boeing's safety culture.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one that's I've also got on my reading list, because it's a, they said it was safety related. It was only released a few weeks ago, a month ago, actually, February 26th. So I'll send you the link, because I think it's a, having read the first couple of paragraphs, it's quite an interesting read, but I haven't had the time to sort of sit down and digest the whole thing.
Right.
Yeah, no, send that article. It'd be an interesting look at. Yeah, like on the outside looking in, obviously, you know, my engineering background, I went to school for mechanical engineering, so everyone's very interested in this sort of stuff. I don't have as much feet in the mechanical world as much anymore. I do more civil work, but it's interesting. It's interesting. I think part of why I've been thinking about what I've sort of deemed the big squeeze, and I might have to change it, but I think, you know, sort of what you talked about there with that article and what I've been seeing and sort of thinking and what people seem to be feeling is, I think a lot of it is sort of like a large portion of the workforce going to retire and how companies are dealing with it right now. And it's not super smooth, but I hope, obviously I hope these, you know, as people come out of poverty, which they are, I think officially now, let me double check this before I want to say it and then I'll fact check it, which is not the right way to do it. But I think now more people are dying from obesity than poverty. Let me just check.
Really?
I think so. Let me double check this. But if this is the case, which we'll find out in a sec, we're going to see more people traveling, right? Everyone wants to travel, it's just going to get busier and busier and busier.
Yeah. And actually always brings me back to something. So my old the dean of the College of Aviation at Western Michigan, where I went to university, Zane Tetau, he's a really cool guy. He used to be chief pilot at United and he won Top Gun awards and things like that. Just coolest guy ever. I'm going off on a tangent here, but he's a really nice guy. And he refused to let people call him by any sort of title. He was just Dave.
Mm-hmm.
He used to always say to every new student and everyone he listened to, he says, you've got to realize that the amount of people entering the middle class is growing. And that contributes to the success of our industry, because when people enter middle class and they have a disposable income, one of the first things they start to do is travel. And it, you know, people want to see the world. And I think there's an incredible truth in that, because, you know, you and I have both been fortunate enough to travel and live abroad and kind of made the most of that. And that there really is a world worth traveling. There's a world worth living. And there's loads of people who should have that opportunity. There's loads of cool places around the world that I still want to see and that people should have the opportunity to see. But, you know, there's the existential challenge of how do we scale that up? How do we make that sustainable? How do we make sure that happens without the impact to everything else, without the impact to the environment?
Yeah.
You know, technology's got to bring us there. Technology's brought us this far, and you know, in not a very long period of time, we're only talking about 100 years or so of civil commercial aviation.
Yeah,
if we've done that in 100 years, we can do a lot more in the next 100, and we should, and we must, because you know, there's a lot of really cool things and a lot of really cool opportunities in this world that people have. You know, my family moving around, you know, ourselves, as we said, with jobs and things, we wouldn't have had those opportunities if it wasn't for
planes.
If it wasn't for planes, yeah. And
yeah,
like you said, the poster on my wall behind me, Living in the Age of Airplanes, which if you're a nerd, if you're not a nerd, it's a lovely little Nat Geo film to watch, little documentary piece. And I won't spoil it for you, but there's a really nice moment at the end.
Okay.
Where they talk about, you know, they talk about the overall journey of how civil aviation and what aviation's done in the span of like 100 years.
Yeah.
And then they talk about that. There's a really nice line at the end. I won't spoil it for you. Go watch it.
Okay.
I promise you, it's worth it. Yeah. It's a really lovely thing to think about. But yeah, as you said, we've got to make sure it's safe. We've got to make sure it's sustainable. And we've got to give people the opportunity, because it's, you know, it's the right thing to do. The sort of sense that I've had this opportunity and now I want to make sure that others can as well.
Yeah.
As far as I possibly can. I'm not going to change the world. I don't think so. But we all do our bit, right?
Yeah, you can help. And the more we interact with each other, probably the more empathy we'll have. And just, you know, not just diversity of like seeing how other people are doing things and improving, but also just, you know, you're more likely to get along with someone if you've met them and chatted with them. And I think that that means something with the people in countries as well. But I think this I think this is a nice note to leave this on. I think we found a real nice break to end it. So thanks so much. I would love to do this again. Probably not back to back. Maybe we'll try and fit someone else in. And I haven't been doing this much recently, unfortunately. But this has been nothing but fascinating. And we spent very little time talking about planes, which I said before, I don't usually write anything down because then you can't go on tangents. And all I was thinking about was let the man talk about planes. We probably only spent like 10 minutes on that.
Yeah, well, let's do one on planes. I'll be very happy to one specifically on planes, and we can maybe that's when we end up doing a little bit more scripted.
Yeah, we could do that.
Just so we cover a few different things. I don't know. Do your listeners write in, Jaden? Do they tell us about things they want to hear about? Are there things that people want to hear about planes?
My mom will let me know when she after she listens to this. No,
I'm sure my mom will let me know as well.
Perfect. Yeah, I'll try and package this up today and get it out. But no, I don't actually know how many people have listened to anything. But yeah, I don't know. I just mostly do it for fun, and it's a nice little time capsule of my travels and the people that I've met. So
absolutely, I love the idea, to be honest, and probably something to be said at the beginning of it, but we can say it at the end.
Yeah.
I love the idea. Thank you. It's really fascinating. You know, your life becomes a sort of combination of all the things you've done, all the people you've met, all the things you've learned. And it's just a really nice way of keeping track of it. Even if it's just for posterity, even if it's just for your own sort of reflection at a later stage or memory at a later stage. Because I'll close on this. We were talking to my dad about this, and we said some of his friends and some of the cool things they've done, and with our grandparents as well, just wish that you could have sat them down at some point and spoken to them for a couple of hours and just have a recording of them telling you
what
this stuff was like. So yeah, I'm sure at some point, you know, this will all be uploaded into the Matrix, and in 20 years time, we'll listen back and have a laugh.
Yeah, I hope so. Alrighty, well, take care and enjoy. I think it's morning for you, afternoon for me, so it's almost noon for you. Go get yourself some lunch.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
Right. Thanks, Jake.
Take care, buddy.
We'll be in touch.
Yeah.
Yeah. Send me the link when it's all done.
Will do. Okay.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.